is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from a national and international perspective. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. Today we discuss the works of Steve Early, the prominent American labor journalist and commentator. But first, here's this week's labor news update.
In the wake of the new federal budget, a poll produced by the Broadbent Institute has found enormous support for measures to fund public services and stop wealth inequality. The Broadbent Institute, established last year by former NDP leader Ed Broadbent, carried out the poll in conjunction with Environics, a widely respected polling firm that also works with the CBC. The poll finds a remarkable 77% of Canadians are concerned about the widening income gap between the rich and poor, and 42% believe wealth inequality should be at the top of the political agenda. Two-thirds of the population are also willing to pay more taxes to protect health care, education, and retirement programs, while 83% support greater taxes upon the wealthiest and 73% greater taxes on corporations. The poll mirrors the findings of an Ontario Federation of Labour poll released March 30th that found 58% in favour of raising corporate taxes and 74% in favour of raising taxes on the wealthy.
Air Canada is threatening to discipline and possibly fire Paul Strachan, president of the Air Canada Pilots Association, for comments he made on CBC's Langan O'Leary exchange. Asked about Avios, the maintenance firm for Air Canada aircraft that declared bankruptcy on March 18th, Strachan said, quote, "I'm saying that certainly it's a consideration for you as a traveler going forward. If we are now going to, for instance, in the case of Avios, offshore depot-level maintenance activities to third parties and other jurisdictions who may or may not be held to the same standards that our people are." Referring to an Avios-owned aircraft maintenance operation in El Salvador, where workers are paid only $16,000 a year, Strachan added, quote, "My question to you then is this the man you want maintaining the aircraft that you fly on so frequently? I suspect not." Meanwhile, the federal government's heavy-handed intervention in a series of Air Canada disputes has opened up a public criticism from trade unionists, ordinary Canadians, and academics. Rate has defended her back-to-work legislation last month against pilots, baggage handlers, mechanics, and ground crew, but continues to assert that her position isn't driven by ideology, but that it is done out of reluctance, but ultimately because the so-called flying public had to be protected. George Smith, former Air Canada executive and current industrial relations professor at Queen's University, said Rate's intervention was, quote, "short-term gain for long-term pain. Air Canada has been in a toxic, dysfunctional relationship with its unions, and those problems get swept under the carpet. Ottawa is basically putting major changes in collective agreements in a holding pattern," end quote.
On April 9th, representatives of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario walked out of a one-hour meeting with Ontario Education Minister Lauren Broughton over upcoming contracts. The Ontario government has demanded a so-called voluntary wage freeze from Ontario's teachers over the next 3 years to help reduce budget costs. While claiming it to be voluntary, McGuinty has not ruled out back-to-work legislation against teachers forced into a strike position. FO says that they will negotiate school board to school board, and they reject the province's demand for a wage freeze, calling it an effective wage cut.
A bus driver from Mississauga Transit was suspended for 5 days for taking a bathroom break deemed by the employer to be a deliberate delay of service. Nicholas Bai, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1572, representing Mississauga Transit workers, called the disciplinary action a serious violation of rights. The city has accused the union of misrepresenting the situation to the public, but refuses to disclose its version of events. According to the union, there has been an ongoing struggle since 1988 to improve the existing bathroom break policy.
On April 5th, dozens of workers in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland, protested at the Cornerbrook Pulp and Paper Mill over contracting out and layoffs. The mill, owned by Montreal-based Kruger, laid off 39 workers in February of this year, all of them unionized with either the Communication Energy and Paper Workers Union or the Machinists. Since the layoffs, Kruger has been hiring contract workers for maintenance of the mill. An internal company memo leaked to the CBC in January revealed plans by Kruger to make mills such as Cornerbrook's operate with fewer workers like other mills owned by the company in Canada.
A major Ottawa Valley employer, Haley Industries, located in between Arnprior and Pembroke, has locked out nearly 400 workers. Contract negotiations involving a provincial mediator broke down on March 15th. The workers, represented by Steelworkers Local 4820, voted 96% in favor of strike action on March 26th. The company locked the workers out on April 3rd, the same day the union was in a legal strike position. The local's chief steward, Peter Vanderbloek, described the last offer by the company as an insult. He added, quote, "Wages is basically what we are after. We don't want to be put out here but we don't want to be treated like garbage. We need the community behind us. These people spend a lot of money in the community, and they, Magellan, owner of Haley Industries, are treating us like shit.
On March 28th, thousands of residents in New York's five boroughs woke up to discover free public transit at 20 different subway stations. This was made possible by the efforts of Occupy Wall Street activists, trade unionists, and rank-and-file members of the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 100. The fare strike was in response to the constant underfunding of public transit, rising user fees, service cuts, and employer attacks on transit workers. The New York City fare strike was followed by a day of protest on April 4th in several American cities demanding transit justice. The high-profile cooperative relationship between Occupy Wall Street and the New York Transit Workers Local 100 have opened up new possibilities of cooperation between unions and the wider working class who rely on public transit. The struggle for accessible, affordable, and well-funded public transit continues to mount across North America as austerity budgets at every level of government place serious limits and often significant cuts on public transit. Cities like Toronto are already witnessing the emergence of a transit justice movement with a variety of groups pushing for overlapping goals, whether the restoration of former Mayor Miller's Transit City or the campaign for free and accessible transit. However, as exemplified by recent transit strikes in Halifax, Ottawa, and Toronto, transit worker unions have a huge problem gaining public support. The fare strike in New York City may show the way forward for transit unions on how to gain that wider public support when they are in tough bargaining. Likewise, the fare strike gives a concrete strategy for how organized transit riders might begin to build bridges with transit workers.
That's this week's Labor News Update. Stay tuned after these messages for more Rank and File Radio.
Smoke's Poutinery has come to Kingston, bringing you over 20 types of poutine in a new and unique way. Smoke's Poutinery is located at 183 Division Street, at the corner of Princess and Division. Bring the whole team for the Smoke's Poutinery experience. How do you like your poutine?
If you're looking for the best in goth, industrial, dark wave, and other music of the night, come to the Dark Carnival. Every Friday evening from 10 to 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM, 90.9 cable. We play the best dark music, cover the local scene, and look at the world beyond. For a weekly celebration of goth culture, enter the Dark Carnival. Embrace the darkness.
In the days when this old hat was new.
Memories old, memories new. Memories just for you. Join me every Saturday morning right after BBC News here on CFRC for This Old Hat.
Are you interested in social justice or environmental issues? Do you want to make local connections to global issues? And do you want to break outside the Queen's bubble? Well, sign up for the Ontario Public Interest Research Group's free newsletter, Ear to the Ground. It's emailed out once a week and is full of local events such as speakers, films, festivals, community arts, and activist action alerts. You can subscribe on the OPIRG Kingston website. Go to www.oprg.org or call 533-3189.
Welcome back to Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM. On this segment of the show, Andrew will be reviewing two books by union activist and labor journalist Steve Early. His books, Civil Wars in Labor, Birth of a New Workers' Movement or Death Throes of the Old, published by Haymarket Books, and Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home, by Monthly Review Press, provide critical accounts of challenges confronting trade unions and their members. Andrew?
Well, thanks, Doug. Steve Early has been an activist, a writer, a trade union organizer, and a staffer for in the trade union movement for well over three decades. His two books, as you mentioned, provide critical accounts of the challenges confronting trade unions and their membership. What sets Early's work apart, most importantly, from other literature on labor studies and industrial relations is his examination of the internal struggles that characterize debates and division within unions. I think put together, Civil Wars and Embedded provide the reader with Early's unapologetic style of writing about working America. He's also a leading proponent of what he calls minority opinions within unions, which means as he has been viewed with suspicion by union officers and leaders whom he has publicly criticized. It's important to emphasize the author's self-described genre of, quote, literary and participatory journalism. Early has penned countless articles that have appeared in the Wall Street Journal and online media sites like Counterpunch, which means that embedded with organized labor and civil wars, take from this experience and address the significance of writing about labor and unionism in an accessible fashion. But his work still remains thorough and in-depth, so nothing is lost in his way of writing. But most importantly, the book can be read as a how-to guide for academics that are attempting to make their research known to a broader audience. At the outset of Embedded, Early recognizes that much of the writing breaks what he calls the so-called two cardinal rules of business unionism, that is, not criticizing or meddling in the internal affairs of another union. And Early admits to having violated both principles as a member of the miners' union reform movement in the United States, where trusteeships or the amalgamation of unions, locals, were being used by UMW President John Lewis to disempower the rank and file. And his reputation, Early's reputation anyways, as a critical labor insider, secured his ban from the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU convention, in 2008, and security was actually called to remove Early from the event altogether. What Early reveals through his biographical insights is a commitment and belief in union democracy. And I think this is really the core of what Early talks about in both of these books. A practice, he says, that is evident in his parent union, the Communication Workers of America, the CWA. Early draws from a range of historical accounts like Richard Boyer's and Herbert Morris's Labor's Untold Story, and Jane Madel's and James Higgins' Them and Us Struggles of a Rank-and-File Union, among other sources. In fact, it's Early's rich engagement with history and social commentary that makes Embedded with Organized Labor and Civil Wars so relevant. And throughout the book, the author traces the racial, class, and gender dimensions of trade unionism history in the United States, as well as the extent to which these social relations produce new forms of dissent and change within the labor movement. The protagonists in Early's work are the working class intellectuals and rank and file activists that aim to transform their unions and participate in a broader social change. And such heroic characters are contrasted, for instance, to the conservative elements of trade union organizations, mostly what are identified as the entrenched leadership in the established AFL-CIO, as well as leading private and public sector unions in the U.S. And one example is the story of the New York City construction workers who, in May of 1970, attacked a crowd of anti-war demonstrators on Wall Street. This became, Early argues, what he says, quote, an encounter emblematic of the Vietnam era, where a battle of political stereotypes unfolded in the public eye and eventually played up by the media. 3 years earlier, delegates at the AFL-CIO convention overwhelmingly voted down, I believe it was 2006, voted down an anti-war resolution, which signified a commitment to the political establishment and labor's conflicted affiliations and tendencies. And as the author suggests, this was a symptom of the broader disconnect between the trade union movement and the civil rights movement and other struggles erupting in American society at the time.
In the past two decades, there have been a couple of high-profile attempts at reforming the American labor movement. One was the election of John Sweeney to the presidency of the AFL-CIO in 1995. And the second was an actual split in the AFL-CIO and the formation of a labor federation called Change to Win, and that was in 2005. While giving listeners a brief idea of these two events, how does Early address them? Did he see these efforts as putting labor on the right track?
Early talks about this thoroughly in Embedded with Organized Labor. When John Sweeney was elected to the American Federation of Labor presidency in 1995, an era of what Early describes as glasnost, referring to Gorbachev's reforms in the Soviet Union, started to emerge. Sweeney's rise marked, as Early describes it, a period of open discussion and criticism of union problems, which had been forbidden under the earlier regimes of George Meany and Lane Kirkland, both past presidents of the AFL. And union activists and officials joined academics in beginning a dialogue about what was necessary for union renewal and growth. And according to Early, critics who had routinely chided American unions for their lack of militancy in progressive politics, like well-known sociologist Stanley Aronowitz, started to applaud Sweeney's insurgent leadership. But Early provides a dim review of the changes that were provoked and brought about by Sweeney's presidency. Labor's so-called old guard might have been eased out, and many of the new faces of influence are more energetic, racially and gender diverse, but the author suggests that the leadership remains an appointed officialdom. Rank-and-file activism and democracy is still elusive, if it was ever an objective of those who held positions of power. And as trade union density continues to decline in the U.S., it is fair to ask what really came from this hopeful revitalization. A decade after Sweeney's reform movement swept into power, Early talks about the rise of Change to Win, which was a coalition of American labor unions that broke away from the AFL-CIO to form a new federation. Now, this was spearheaded by then-president of the SEIU, Andy Stern, and the CTF, the Change to Win Federation, evolved from the New Unity Partnership, an alliance of unions that focused on organizing new members through union consolidation and the development of a political strategy aimed at building what is described as union market share. And there was a wide acclaim for this new federation, which initially held almost a third of the AFL-CIO's membership, and its potential for organizing hundreds of thousands of workers employed in the service sector, where most of the country's low-wage jobs are found. And according to Early, and this builds on the question that you asked, the Change to Win Federation offered promise to the most exploited American workers. The Teamsters, the SEIU, the United Farm Workers, and the UFCW, which are the remaining four members of the Federation, all have a rich history of organizing immigrant Latin American and African American workers. Now, what Early takes to task and embedded is the intensely hierarchical and business unionist strategy ultimately adopted by the Change to Win Federation's leading members, namely the SEIU and the Teamsters. Both of these unions came to represent the worst features of the AFL-CIO under the leadership of Meany and Kirkland, namely the opposition to internal dissent and the authority of appointed decision makers over that of the rank-and-file membership. What Early concludes is that the aim of enhancing so-called union market share without a concern for democracy and membership control has its consequences. And over time, Early charts what happens with density without democracy, which eventually culminates in a lack of financial accountability and transparency, which is a symptom of undemocratic politics and a contributing factor leading to union scandals and corruption, all of which is part of the business union model attacked in the book, or both of the books.
A huge chunk of civil wars in U.S. labor revolves around the SEIU and its former president, Andy Stern, who you've already mentioned. He's highly critical of the SEIU's organizing strategies, its relationships with other unions, and its internal structures. What are these problems within SEIU, and why does Early give these problems so much significance? Does he see these problems having a wider impact on the American labor movement?
It would be inaccurate to say that Early is simply talking about or criticizing one union. I think he's taking on a range of issues, namely centralization of power and undemocratic tendencies. Early's chief criticism against the SEIU tactics is that they mirror corporate practices, namely the fascination with the use of mergers and acquisitions as a way of making unionism more efficient, and using that language. Both embedded in organized labor and civil wars evidence this through countless interviews, articles, and news reports from several sides, whether it's leaders in the SEIU or the trade union movement, dissident rank-and-file activists, and other trade unionists. And it is really a quote from Stern himself that captures Early's argument most effectively when the then SEIU president stated in response to resistance over the convergence of a particular group of SEIU locals, quote, "Workers want their lives to be changed. They want strength and a voice, not some purist, intellectual, historical, mythical democracy." And I think to some extent Stern was responding to academic circles imagining trade union democracy and him accusing them of being out of step with reality. Now, Early concedes that there is truth in the SEIU providing a home for the country's working poor, and the union's early victories can be attributed to a social unionism that used activism to mobilize workers successfully. The SEIU spearheading of justice for janitors, for example, is just one such initiative in Canada and the United States that has seen so much success. Even Stern is characterized as having successfully replaced the so-called crooks and grifters that once ran some of the SEIU locals. By contrast, the SEIU has also been host to the most public and vicious internal union battles in the last decade, a battle Early emphasizes in both books that have been waged between independent locals on one hand, their membership, with and against the central union officers. As American unions struggle for relevance, Early argues that Andy Stern adopted a collaborationist strategy of working with major corporations to ensure certification victories. This is most pronounced in the healthcare industry sector in California and throughout the United States. I think even more telling of the directional shift is the SEIU's attempt to have a seat at the policymaking table within the Republican Party through, I believe it was a $10,000 donation. Now, from Puerto Rico, where public school teachers were pressed into certifying with the SEIU-backed Union of Puerto Rican Teachers, to the parent union's takeover of United Healthcare Workers West in 2009, the SEIU's leadership has used trusteeships and appointments as principal strategies to maintaining influence over the union. In the Puerto Rican case, for example, Early characterizes the action as a form of labor colonialism, whereby the SEIU worked with a local politician to break up the existing teachers' union. Journalists like Amy Goodman and labor scholars like Nelson Lichtenstein, among others, have been vocal opponents to UHW trusteeship on the grounds that the move disenfranchises members. So there is criticism from a number of circles about SEIU tactics and its broader strategy. Within U.S. academic circles, similar rifts have opened between researchers who stand with the SEIU and those who oppose it, or rather its tactics. As Early recognizes in Civil Wars, and I think this is important for our academic listeners, if academics don't remain neutral, he argues, they can find themselves without union support for their teaching, writing, and research. It goes without saying that the millions of dollars spent by the SEIU to secure the takeover of union locals, as well as the resources mobilized by members determined to fight the trusteeships, are devoted to combating allies rather than organizing new workers. And really, such is the consequence of a labor organization that, in the words of an SEIU critic cited in Civil Wars, wants to be, quote, the Walmart of unions. So moving towards a corporate and efficiency-based structure does not stop with trusteeships, of course. Early provides a thorough examination of the SEIU's deployment of call centers as a mechanism through which the union interfaces with members, and the project was sold really as a comeback strategy. But it's arguable that because of the centralization of the SEIU, it's actually become a requirement, given its size and the scope of managing over 2 million members. Both of Early's books ask what has come from Stern's non-adversarial approach with companies and Stern's mission to abandon the trade union movement's so-called class struggle mentality. Dissident SEIU members and critics referenced in Civil Wars claim that the union leadership has cut deals with companies behind members' backs. On the other hand, in 2005, the SEIU won a hard-fought victory for childcare workers represented by Local 888 in New Jersey through a mix of direct action tactics and political lobbying. So there is both really success and failures in the strategies adopted by the SEIU leadership. I think most telling is Early remains skeptical that the SEIU has made real gains for some of the poorest workers, despite concessions and Stern's appeal to responsible unions. Sal Rosselli, former president of the embattled United Healthcare Workers West, comments, quote, Stern's multi-million dollar fights have diverted resources away from healthcare reform and employee free choice, weakening the former and scuttling the latter. And Rosselli here was speaking to organized labor's response to Obamacare and the virtual abandonment of the Employee Free Choice Act, which we've talked about on the show before, which was, as we know, one of President Obama's campaign commitments to the working class in American unions. So ultimately, Stern left the SEIU unable to pay its bills, undemocratic, and unwilling to defend its members, according to Early's review. Early questions I think quite accurately, the contributions made by the so-called 60s radicals like Stern, who took charge of the country's most influential labor unions. It's not an accusation that their leadership has been ineffective, but rather that the entrenched bureaucratic power of a professional cadre of appointees has simply been reconstituted with new faces. And Early concludes that since the 1990s, there, quote, seemed to be a glib assumption that any solid 60s political resume guaranteed laudatory results in subsequent labor work. Such assumptions were fanned by labor scholars of the same generation who now saw their peers taking over the offices once occupied by conservative labor leaders. And the point is, there is no substitute for rank-and-file participation in democracy. And you can have activists and graduate students and those who are recent graduates as staffers, but you cannot substitute the rank-and-file workers within a union with appointees.
So what sort of criticism has Early come under for his work, and is the criticism justified?
That's a good question. I think it's something to consider when we think about dissent within any organization, especially trade unions. As I said, Early was tossed out of the SEIU convention in 2008. And if you look at reviews of his work and of Early, they tend to be positive. I think there are some SEIU members that, especially in the leadership, who argue that there is something poisonous about his work, that by breaking the cardinal rules of criticizing and meddling in a union's affairs, he's made public the problems and has added to right-wing assaults. And I don't think that's the case. I think many people see in his work, and his work actually reflects these voices, that there is importance in militancy and rank-and-file democracy. And it's hard to vilify an author and a trade unionist for making such claims.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That was Andrew's review of Steve Early's two books, Civil Wars in Labor and Embedded with Organized Labor, books put out by Haymarket Books and Monthly Review Press, respectively. That's all the time we have this week. Please join us next week, Wednesday, 5:30 p.m., for more Rank and File Radio.